This podcast is brought to you with thanks to Systema, managed IT and cloud services.
The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Welcome everyone to a wonderful Wednesday. You're on FNR Football Nation Radio, Australia's first and only 24-hour radio station dedicated to the beautiful, beautiful game of football. I'm Carlos Alberto Diego, and this is the Journos Wednesday edition with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. You can join in the conversation anytime this hour on 0399 44 99 and of course on Twitter at FNR underscore radio. Good morning to you, Jonathan.
Good morning, Carlos.
Yes, there's so much to talk to you today. The grand final on the weekend, the Socceroos squad, there's all that stuff. There's other issues to talk about. Some interesting transfers too, by the way, between clubs already that we need to talk about. But we're going to start off today, with the AAFC, the advent of that organisation, and also the issues around the Congress. There's been a lot of work done in, collating data from the grassroots and from the NPL clubs, and paper 5 years of the NSL, or sorry, of the NPL, a club's perspective, a report by AAFC on behalf of the NPL member clubs was released in the last 24 hours. And Rebbie Crayham, the chairman of the AAFC, is joining us this morning to have a chat about it. Good morning to you, Rebbie.
Good morning, Carlos. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Ravi. Can you tell us briefly, just to start off with, a quick summary of what it is that you released yesterday?
Well, what we released yesterday was a report on the findings of our travel, our roadshow, our consultation with the clubs, the NPL clubs, and other stakeholders about where the NPL is, from their perspective, 5 years in. There's been a lot of issues raised over the past 12 months about, which have been broadly raised even on your programs in relation to the cost structures, the viability, the whole NPL. And, and I think for the first time we've produced a report that summarises the views across the country from a constructive sense, what needs to be improved, what is actually working. The NPL has changed from 5 years ago when it first started where it is today. And the inconsistencies across the board. So I think what we've produced, which we delivered the report to the FFA yesterday, as well as the member federations, was to say, this is across the country, this is the NPL, this is where we are with it. And the support for the NPL is very, very strong amongst the clubs, but we need to improve the NPL, to address the issues of both the clubs, the coaches, players and parents. And I think what we've done is documented what people have been talking publicly, but for the first time, there's a detailed report which goes to the governing body to say, this is how we can work together to improve the NPL and take it to the next level.
Rabbi, the catalyst of the report, was it the issues around the Congress, or was the AAFC going to be an organisation that was going to come together anyway to address this? Because you'd think after 5 or 6 years that there would have to be some sort of assessment on that NPL model that would start off where we thought it was going to look a certain way, but as your report points out, it hasn't really eventuated that way.
Well, the issue that we have, Carlos, is that there is not every state federation runs the NPL differently in different ways. There's not consistencies. I think there's been reviews done at a state level, but I don't believe there's been a review done from a national perspective. And what we have done is taken the national perspective on the NPL and to show the inconsistencies in the rollout of the NPL of what was supposed to be a model that was supposed to create more players and more opportunities, but all it's done is, yes, it's created some opportunities, but what we've done is put financial burdens on clubs. We've made the game more expensive. We've made coaching more expensive, and we've actually placed a lot more pressure on what was deemed to be a national, second-tier competition. But there is 172 clubs playing across the country, all supposed to be operating off the same criteria with the same ethos, and it's not working.
What comes through quite clearly, Rabbi, in the report is that there's a belief in the NPL as an entity. This isn't a hatchet job where you're just trying to take down a competition in with the intent of creating a revolution. There is goodwill out there for this system that was designed 6 years ago to actually operate as it was designed at the time.
Absolutely. There's no. This is not about. I think, as very clearly outlined in our report, the clubs across the board support the concept of the NPL. There's no question about that. And I think there's a lot of good that's come out of the NPL. But the way the NPL was delivered, you know, five, six years ago to where we are today is completely different. And so, therefore, it needs to be tweaked to meet the current needs. I mean, when the NPL rolled out 5, 6 years ago, the A-League clubs didn't have their academies involved in the NPL. Now we have them. So there's a whole inconsistency across the board of what the entitlements are. But one thing that hasn't been addressed is if you're going to have a national program, it's got to be consistent everywhere you go. But the inconsistencies is forcing clubs, to not know where they're after or Martha in a lot of ways. And it's putting undue pressures. I mean, the prime example we use is the NPL clubs invest in the development of the game over $50 million a year. Now, that's a lot of money collectively that gets invested in the development of the game. Are we getting the best value out of that investment in the game? The answer is no, we're not. So we have to work is there's no question there is a lot of money involved in the development of the game in Australia. How do we work smarter and how do we capitalise on what has been in 5 years a product that has a lot of potential we can take to the next level? And I think that's the exciting part is that no one is saying the NPL needs to go. What everyone is saying, we need to learn what has worked, what hasn't worked, how do we tweak it, and how do we take it to the next level? And I think that's where the clubs are coming from and want to help make it work consistently.
Now, Rabbi, it seems to me that the inconsistencies has come about because the FFA, whether it's been officially done or unofficially, basically relinquished controls to the member federations. Now, if it was a model that was constructed with the FFA involved and they're not involved right now, I can see why there's inconsistencies throughout the different federations because of the different imperatives that every federation has, their clubs, the influence of those clubs on those federations. That was always going to happen. Is that how you see or the clubs have seen as the problem? And do they, I believe they want to revert back to the FFA actually controlling this whole thing?
I think there's no question. Everyone has a role to play and everyone has been part of the issue. There's no doubt the FFA is as guilty as member federations as some of the clubs are. So this is not about saying who's to blame to where we are today. This is we've got to where we are because there's been the rollout of the NPL model, which was supposed to be consistent, was inconsistent. And I think what we're saying, to make the NPL to capitalise on the revenue opportunities, the marketing opportunities and to bring costs down, there needs to be, through the FFA, they are the governing body, needs to take control of the NPL to make sure there is a consistent rollout and to capitalise on national opportunities for the NPL. And work conjunctly with the member federations. But at the moment, you've got the FFA who controls the NPL, because it's their competition, delegated down to the member federations, who then tweak it their own way and the pressures of the clubs. So therefore, we get inconsistency. A prime example of that is the play point system. We operate, you would think in the play point system, every state would operate on the same level. We're not. You operate in some states on 200 points, some states on 170 points. So how can we get that basic wrong, just a simple point system? That doesn't make any sense.
So what are the next steps from here, Rabbi, to actually convert this report into something something practical, something that's applied?
Well, I think the key for us is that we've been in dialogue with the FFA. I did have a chat with David Gallup yesterday, and which they're going through the report. I think the exciting part is that the FFA have embraced that what the AFC have delivered, in a sense, and we're looking to work with the member federations and the FFA. We're not anti any of that. We're here to work, and I think. Then the discussions I've had with the FFA executive is that they've appreciated that the clubs are coming with solutions, not just dumping problems on them. And it's not about saying it's your fault. It's not about pointing fingers. It's saying, here it is. Let's take it forward. Let's work together. And ultimately, how do we deliver three? The three key things, the biggest gripes, cost of play, junior players to play NPL, the financial viability of the clubs in relation, the clubs spend a lot of money in development, but all of a sudden they lose players, but there's no compensation coming down to the clubs. And the coaching education, the cost of coaching education places a great burden. And I think those three things are, you talk to anybody in NPL, whether it's a club, player, coach, parent, they're the three top of mind things. So I think the next stage for us is we're in the process of organising further meetings with the FFA to go through the report, and we've given some recommendations, and the key for us is to work together to deliver those. Because if we don't, we haven't learned anything. And I think one thing the game has to move forward is you've got to learn from the past. We're 5 years, 6 years into the NPL. The goalposts have changed. We're saying the AFC, representing the clubs, want to work with a governing body to take to the next level. And I think no one can knock that back. We're here to help. We're not here to hinder.
Rabbi, at what point do the A-League clubs or their association get involved in this conversation? Because it doesn't seem in the paper that I've read, and I've only skimmed through it I only received it yesterday, it doesn't seem like they're being part of this conversation. Given that you're talking about compensation for players, given that you're trying to identify the role of, or define the role of NPL in the whole pathway in Australia, they've got to come into the conversation at some stage, don't they?
Oh, look, there's no doubt. But I think what we're trying to determine is, where do the A-League academies fit into this structure? Not just the A-League academies, the impact of private academies as well. There's no doubt the A-League class play an integral part of this whole process. But the whole junior development program is dictated by the FFA of the whole process. So the idea is that they've got to bring the parties together. What we've provided to the FFA, the governing body, the perspective from the NPL clubs. I've got no doubt the A-League clubs are probably giving similar things to the FFA, but when you consider that the 172 clubs who make up the majority of the NPL nationally, this is the views. And I think all we've done is documented what people have been saying for the last 3-4 years. But you've got to grab the A-League clubs, obviously play a key part because they've got their own academies. They need to understand how does it work. Because you've got to make sure that we're giving the kids every opportunity to succeed. And the A-League clubs play an integral part of that.
And how does this sit in relation to the development of a second tier that you've also been working on with FFA? Does this relate to it, or is it a reflection of the discontent that's caused the requirement for a second tier?
Well, I think the second tier plays a part, because the establishment of a second tier competition has an impact on the NPL, what's it going to look like. But I think they come hand in hand, and I think in our report we've made it very clearly one of the key things is in the future planning the NPL. What we're saying, there should be a 10-year strategy for the NPL, and part of that strategy takes account, if you have a second tier competition, second division, what impact does it have on the NPL? And I think they do come hand in hand, because you need to address it now. Now, whether the second division happens in 2019 or 2021, if you don't address it as part of the strategy for the NPL, you've learnt nothing from the past.
Mm. If you wanted centralised, control of this, for example, FFA really taking control of it and mandating every league around Australia to be consistent across the board as the clubs are calling for, the reality is the FFA don't have the resources to run the game as it is. So suddenly, if they've got to take this on and do a proper job of it, it has to go hand in hand, I believe, with an independent A-League, doesn't it, where they relinquish that. And suddenly, you almost got the English FA type set up. And Johnson, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the English FA look more and control the Football League while the Premier League looks after itself. Is that how it works there?
So the Football League is its own entity. The FA, the Premier League, is its own entity, and the FA operates the rest of the game. So, in that context, the NPL would sit under the FA's jurisdiction in England.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, what the FFA probably don't want to hear right now is that they need a very, very important thing to be done again by them, Rabbi. So the practicality of this.
Yeah. Look, I think there's no doubt we've said that needs to sit under and we're happy to help. I mean, when people talk about money, the interesting part about we can find money to sign marquee players, which is a band-aid solution, but we can't find money to give kids the opportunity what we need for football. And I think it's, one minute we're crying poor, the next minute we can find money for things that fix a band-aid solution or something. I think from the FFA perspective is that if it's to be a truly in the NPL, it's their program they designed. There's been a significant investment over the last 5 years in the NPL. What has lacked is a consistent, what's lacked is that no one at an FFA level has focused on how do you derive more revenue out of the NPL. I mean, you've got a fantastic competition from senior football for men and women down to grassroots in around 40 to 50,000 players within that NPL structure. But no one gives it the attention to derive more revenue out of it, to make it more successful financially and take the burden. The NPL clubs nationally contribute up the line in fees, licence fees, registration, around $9 million to member federations, to zones, to the FFA. Use that sort of money to put together and how do you market the NPL nationally? And I think marketing the NPL to the next level, creating a second division, the expansion of the A-League all come hand in hand. And when we talk about, how do you engage with people? How do you convert those people into supporters of the highest level? That's where you start. And you give people the opportunity that if I'm a 9-year-old playing SAP, I can play NPL, I can look at an opportunity to play senior NPL, then I can go to youth, second division, A-League. And I think we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We've already invested significant money as a sport nationally. Let's bind it together and bring all tiers together. And I think, we won't have to be worrying about bringing marquee players because people want to come and see our own players play.
Absolutely, Rabbi. I think that whole of game type commitment to the structures around the game is just so important. That's the answer. That's the absolute answer. And we've got to do this. The appetite of the FFA, though, they've got a lot to do right now. They probably think that this is a really important thing to do also. What are the timelines put in place here from your perspective and what you're trying to impose on the FFA? To get this, to get to the next level of discussion around this?
Look, in all discussions I've had with the FFA, it's been very open and they've been very supportive of it. They've been waiting for the report, which we've delivered. It meets what they're looking for. They understand that what has happened and what they've seen. I think they've appreciated the work. Well, I know they've appreciated the work that we have done. Obviously, for us now is to, over the next couple of weeks, organise a face-to-face meeting with the FFA, let them dissect the report, sit down and work, put a strategy together, watch the way forward. At the same time, I mean, we've got a further meeting in mid-June in relation to the second division. So, it's they work separately, but at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is make sure we don't sort of wait for things to happen, is we'll force things to happen and take people through the journey, because otherwise nothing moves, and we're not about that. We've got our members, our clubs, NPL clubs want things to happen, and we've committed to drive that to happen. Until such time as someone says, stop, we're not doing it, then that becomes a different issue. But at the moment, all parties have embraced what we've done. The information is there. Now, whether people agree with some of it or disagree, I think what has happened is that we're the only body so far has put together a national summation of the NPL, and it's cost nobody money except our time, and it hasn't cost consultant to do it. We've done it off our own bat and funded it ourselves, and I think it's a genuine reflection of where the game sits. And I think anyone who reads that report, and I encourage all your listeners, Carlos, to read the report if you're an NPL, if you're a football fan, because all that report covers is exactly what people are thinking, and we put it in writing. And now it's time for the next step. So I'm encouraged that in the next few weeks we'll have face-to-face meetings with the FFA and go to the next step.
Good stuff, Rabbi. At least you've got a tool now, a vehicle to get the conversation going. Got some great recommendations in there. Congratulations on you, AAFC, and also the NPL member clubs who have put this together. It's a great starting point, mate, and we look forward to see it evolve over time.
Thanks, Carlos. Thanks, John. And as I said, all our NPL clubs, mate, they do listen to FNR. It is the NPL station.
Good on you, mate. That's Rabbi Crahan, the chairman of AAFC, on the release of the 5 years of the NPL, a club's perspective, a report by AAFC on behalf of NPL member clubs. It's a much-needed report, Jonathan. For me, it's a starting point. It's a few holes here and there, but look, like I said, it's what the NPL, the assessment of the NPL is by the NPL itself, and I think it's a good starting point.
Yeah, agree completely. I think what's clear is that there's a will. The NPL system, as designed, is still supported by the NPL community. It just isn't operating as efficiently as it should do. And almost as soon as the landscape was designed, it changed. So you look at the purpose of NPL clubs broadly. I'm being very reductive, but on one stream, it's to operate as a high performing football club, and some of these clubs are former top tier professional or semi professional organisations. So they're not in this for halftime lollies. They're doing it because they want to excel at what they do. And hence why the second tier is so important, because they need to be given that freedom to grow. And then the second stream is their role in elite pathway, and in particular youth development. Now, since the NPL was created, you've got this growth of A-League academies where they're effectively siphoning off that junior talent as young as 12 years old now. So their place in the market has been squeezed at both ends, and they need to the game needs to be very careful about how it accommodates them and nurtures them, because they do play an extremely important role. And
they've been starved of incentive, haven't they? There's no incentive. They talk about the 58 million. That figure's in my head for some reason. I again scanned through the document last night, and but millions and millions and millions of dollars spent at that level, but with no incentive.
Completely.
No second division incentive. No play. No pathway incentive. They're just no incentive, and so.
And moreover, just to reinforce that, there's a sense that they've been taken for granted. That, oh, well, they'll do that anyway, so we don't need to deal with it. But exactly as you suggested, they need these incentives.
The two holes, you've got to get the A-League in conversation. They're starting up academies. They're putting up, they're investing in their own academies for their own interests, obviously, and that will never change. So how's that going to be resolved?
So just to let you in on this is a... I don't know how generalised it is, but I was speaking to one A-League club, and it was they struggled to comprehend the idea that some NPL clubs would consider themselves on a par with the A-League. So if you look at it from the outside, if you were a complete outsider coming to the A-League, you go, well, oh, that's your elite. There's your 10 elite clubs. Mm. The rest feeds into that system. That's not how it operates, and that's not how it was designed to operate. So there needs to be a recalibration. And if that is the case, where those 10 at the very top table are in that position, then there needs to be compensation flowing further down the chain. And that doesn't necessarily mean a single transfer fee. There is a whole stack of labour and investment in a player's development. And that has to be reflected from the grassroots upwards, so that, exactly like you said, that there is that incentive to keep the system moving. And I think as we're developing this independent A-League, again, you know, reinforcing your point, that needs to be a significant aspect of how we redraw those relationships. Otherwise, there'll just be this disconnect. And if anything, if you were in an NPL club with a talented kid, and you knew that an A-League club could just pick them off, you'd start farming them overseas.
Yeah. Well, and which clubs are doing?
Completely.
Joondalup in WA have been doing it for years. Players from that, because of the people working there, had connections overseas. Why play for Perth Glory? Let's go straight over there.
Absolutely.
Some some Australian internationals have gone over at 15, 16 at that age, and we've seen that time and time again, because they just don't see that pathway there. Yeah. And I've spoken to so many clubs as part of FNR over the last 8 months, and the majority of them have said to me, nothing gives us more pleasure and pride than some of our players graduating out of our system and going higher. They want to see that. They celebrate that. So it's not like it's all vested interest. We want to keep it within ourselves. They do want to see their kids go on. But I tell you what, the big hole in the paper is that no one talked about the conversation with the A-League clubs. Mm-hmm. And as much as they're looked upon as maybe the ogres here, because they don't give compensation, take all our kids or whatever, they're part of the path. They're part of this ecosystem that you've got to be part of. Yeah. And if you want compensation, you've got to have that conversation with them about, okay, what's that compensation look like? It doesn't have to be money, like you said. It could be anything. And we get a lot of clubs, by the way, already investing in local clubs by having their coaches go down and coach the coaches and other programs that that could be set up in that way there. So I think it's really interesting, but a fantastic document by way of starting point. But I could just imagine the FFA right now being told that, you need to run the NPL. You need to take responsibility. I could just see them saying, under this current model of how we're operating, that's the last thing we want to hear.
It is. I'm sure you're right. But I also get the sense that the AFC have done them a favour, that this is a review that needed to happen, because it's not an adversarial document. It's a document that's saying we support the incentive that you came up with 5 years ago from the review of 2012 that was then implemented, but it needs to be better administered, and this is your remit. You are the governing body. You need to administer this better, and I think there's a willingness to take that on board from FFA, but like you say, finding the time and the money to actually do that is another question. So it all needs to make sense. It can't just exist in isolation, and you know, because we know that there are other very significant governmental pieces happening at the same time. It all has to knit together, which will be...
It's a big whiteboard, isn't it? It's a big whiteboard with the connectors, but they've got to do it.
Yes.
And once we do it, and once we agree on it, and people take responsibility for their roles in it, suddenly we're on the way forward.
And
absolutely.
Do it collegiately. Do it with a sense that this is, you know, start with an end point, which is the ultimate success of football in Australia, and work backwards. Don't just look at it and go, this is what we need right now, or this will solve this short-term problem, and get everybody to buy in that we're all part of an ecosystem. And, and until we all get together and work in collective interest, we'll just keep repeating the same mistake.
And that the word interest is really, really important, because, you know, and Rabbi admitted this, and the NPL clubs are admitting it, that they're at fault too. Within their own member associations, the pressures they put on those associations to have the NPL in their state look a certain way. And they talk about the point system, and they talk about the differences between the member federation. That's because a lot of the clubs push for that in those state federations. So, by the way, they did it because obviously there was no guidance from above, no centralised imposition of how this was going to be set up. So a lot of work to do, but the vested interest has to be put aside for the structure of the what this is going to look like going forward, like you were talking about. That vested interest is going to be put aside to develop that, and then you worry about, you know, your own interests once that is in place. A really interesting topic, and I think we'll have a lot to say about this and discuss about it over the coming months. Let's take a break, Jonathan. When we come back, there's a grand final, there's Socceroos, there's all this other stuff we want to talk about here on the Journos. It is the Wednesday edition with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia here on FNR Football Nation Radio. Back in a sec.
The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Streaming football 24/7, this is FNR Football Nation Radio, live across Australia and live across the world. It's The Journos, Wednesday edition with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia and Carlos Alberto Diego. Now, Jonathan, grand final on the weekend. Terrific final series. I've got to say, you always forget about I used the word lame last week. It's probably a bit tough, but you know, the lack of excitement around the week to week A League this season. But the final series, that's what I remain with. The thoughts of what happened there, fantastic. And the grand final itself, I thought the first half was really good. I think great football by Newcastle. Lawrence Thomas pulling off some great saves. Second half, a really professional performance by Melbourne Victory. And I was disappointed that Newcastle couldn't get beyond that stranglehold that Victory had. In the end, tight grand final, probably not the most memorable, except for one issue, the VAR. But what were your thoughts?
I thought it was a textbook grand final, really. The hype was deserved. There was an incredible atmosphere. There was that 5 or 10 minutes of just frenetic action. And then it settled into a rhythm where eventually the team that won were the team that best managed the occasion. It wasn't, they weren't necessarily the better, they didn't play the better football. They displayed better game sense and were deserved victors in the end. Does it change how I feel about the rest of the season? No, I don't think it does. I still feel like it was a very underwhelming campaign from start to finish. That it had a high point at the right at the correct part of the season is to its benefit. But I think overall, I'm still going to walk away from this thinking, yeah, we can do a lot better, and we need to rectify quite a lot of issues. But you know, credit to Melbourne Victory, what an outstanding way to close the season. Especially considering where they were in such a short time ago. Nobody was really supportive of Kevin Muscat. The captain had just left the club. They were struggling in the Asian Champions League. There were question marks over the form of key players, and they turned it around in a very short space of time.
And that you've got to, doesn't matter what you think of Kevin Muscat. He's a leader there, and he's got to be given credit. Not always the most likable person. He was booed during that phase of the season that you're talking about, where people were questioning the predictability of the team selection, the reluctance to bring in young kids, all those sort of things. Then the club turned around and said, we're going to extend this guy for 2 years. From that moment on, people were disappointed. I saw on social media, people were very, very outraged by the fact that the club did that at that point in time. But from that moment on, it seemed like it calmed everything down, didn't it?
It did. You're absolutely right. I mean, it helped that they had a couple of good wins in the A League, and also a really good Champions League, Asian Champions League win against Kawasaki Frontale. That really kick-started their run home, in my mind, that 90th minute Costa Barbarossa's win over at Amy Park. And I think we now have to reappraise Kevin Muscat as a coach. I think, I have to speak personally. I can't project my view on everybody, but my view was that he inherited a very good situation from Ange Postecoglou. He's got a very high performing football club around him. Paul Trimboli, the most ideal football operations manager. He's got JP DeMarini alongside him to give him that senior expertise. The entire football club operates like a well-oiled machine. We've seen a handover of chief executive this season as smooth as you could imagine. They're a very, very good professional organization. And I've been of the opinion that he's not broken anything up to this point, rather than necessarily shaping it in his design. He's just he's not fiddled with it to the point of breaking. I think we have to reappraise that. Over the past 2 or 3 months, something wasn't working. He's arrested that. And in this final series, he's shown tactical adaptability and got the best out of his players at the end of a difficult season, and one that had an Asian Champions League campaign at an awkward time as well. And he's come out with his second championship as a coach, which is as many as anybody's achieved in the A-League era. So I think from here on, we have to start rethinking of actually how good he is as a coach and what his potential could be in the future.
He's tactical malleability. The fact that he can be flexible tactically was always questioned.
Yeah, I mean, you could pick victories starting
absolutely
11 with your eyes
closed.
The
way they were playing, get it to the wide guys, get it to the cross, it was go forward at all costs. Yep. We never sit back and absorb pressure. That's the way I used to see victory.
Totally.
But against Sydney, they sat back and absorbed pressure. Against Newcastle in that second half, they stopped the game without necessarily threatening their goal. They killed that game.
Yep.
And they did what they had to do to win that game. For me, that was the maturity I saw. I don't think I've seen that before under him, and I certainly haven't seen it under Ange Postecoglou before that.
Yep. I agree entirely.
So which means that he's either listening to people or it was part of his learning as a coach anyway. I was happy to see that because people are now talking about him having similar record to an Ange Postecoglou, which means he's on the trajectory to eventually coach the Socceroos one day.
Yeah.
We need a coach at the Socceroos level who can adapt tactically.
Absolutely.
And that was one question mark I had over Kevin Muscat. So victory won this grand final because, I believe, of the tactical flexibility of the coach and the team.
And not only that, but the game changed at halftime in the grand final, and he would have had that halftime period without JP DeMarini in the room, without Dean Anastasiadis. Who knows if they had phone conversations or whatever.
Yeah.
It didn't look like the tightest the tightest firewall, did it?
I think they were doing FaceTime at the same time. So,
still. It's possible to surmise that this was his operation, not as much a collective effort as might have been the case in the past. So, he deserves enormous credit.
Ernie Merrick's reaction at the end of the game was un-grand final-like, I thought. I thought he lacked a bit of class. So after such a wonderful job he did, especially with the media, not only on the ground, but with the media during the season, I thought it was a different Ernie Merrick to what we remembered back when he was a victory coach, defensive, a siege mentality. Basically, if you weren't a cheerleader for the club, he was dead against you, as Michael Lynch found out. Of course, after the game, he talked about the fact that if he hopes he'd never coach a team that played like victory in that grand final, I thought lacked a bit of class. And also the way he attacked Michael Lynch in the press conference, which I spoke to Michael Lynch about this yesterday, I just thought it was thoroughly unprofessional and it made him look really, really bad.
Yeah, it did. It was sour, unnecessary and unbecoming of a coach and a club that has earned so much goodwill over this season. And you contrast it with Laurie McKenna, who the day after the grand final, when he was well within his rights to sling all sorts of abuse towards what happened because of the breakdown in VAR, and he did the exact opposite. He was genial, he was accommodating, he answered every phone call, and everything that he said really doused what could have been a very inflammatory situation. And I wonder, next time anybody gets hold of Ernie Merrick, I'd be interested to ask him if he would do the same again. Mm. If on reflection, he would be as combative as he was at the time, and perhaps, in hindsight, he'd be a bit more statesmanlike, a bit more. I don't know how to put it. It was as if he lost his role. So he's played a role all season. You know, the Jets are the great underdogs. His team is this great cavalier, young, attacking, and he's the godfather, just nurturing it all through with a smile on his face. And then for a few hours, just something kicked in, that instinct kicked in, and it didn't do him any favours at all.
No, it didn't. And I think in his respect, it really changed my mind again. It just reminded me of what it was like back when he was leading victory all that time. The VAR. Malfunction at that point in time? What's going on, really? I mean, how often does this happen? That's what I want to know. If that malfunction then, why? It'd be reasonable for us to ask the question, how many times during the season do we have a malfunction?
Mm-hmm.
Did we just have to reset the computer? Is that what happened? Did things crash? I mean, tell us what the malfunction was. Don't just, I mean, by the way, I applaud the FFA to come out and say what it was the day after, I think. But I've got all these question marks about, you know, why did this happen? How did it happen? How often has it happened before? And is it likely to happen again?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a shambles, isn't it? And I think more, you know, projecting even further than that, FIFA has to be looking at this and questioning the efficacy of it in a World Cup. You just cannot trust it. It was a nice idea to begin with, and one that deserved trialing. We've lived through a trial. It hasn't worked, and now get rid of it. And if we are even going to retain the pretense that it serves a purpose, you're right. It has to be a completely transparent account of what happened. And moreover, everything that happened during the season, all of the glitches that might have happened that didn't go reported. And as much for the integrity of the people involved, you know, if you're the assistant referee that didn't flag at that situation, it would be great to know, did you think it was offside but borderline enough that VAR would pick it up? If so, that's a significant alteration to how that match was officiated in real time. If you're the video assistant referee, your entire career could now be at threat as a consequence of a technical malfunction. It's just unacceptable, and we've been poorly treated as a consequence of this process from the day it began, really. And we have to confront it, and we have to reject that we're part of what was never a trial, you know, in the academic sense. It was never a case of, okay, here's this idea, let's road test it and then evaluate whether it's fit for purpose further down the line. It was, we're going to have this in the World Cup. This is FIFA, you know. Yep. We're going to have this in the World Cup. We need some more data to iron out some kinks.
And we need some schmucks to do it for us.
Completely.
And we need it in real time where there's real games going on.
Yep.
And what's pleasing for me at least is there are times when our referees have looked incompetent this season and clueless because of this VAR, but we've seen exactly the same when it's been used over in Europe.
Yep.
Experienced referees in the football culture, and at least I'm saying, okay, this can happen to anyone around the world.
And you look overseas, and there's still this, when a single big decision goes against, particularly a bigger team, there's still this knee-jerk reaction that it would have been resolved if it was for VAR.
Yeah.
We are living proof that is not the case. And the Australian message needs to get around the rest of the world. Mm. If this was a legitimate trial, and if we do have the greatest body of evidence, then it needs to be told. We need to alarm the world that this is a bad idea, and nobody else should embrace it until it's at a point where it's fit for purpose. And I do see the benefit. I do, particularly in black and white cases. So, you know,
goal line technology
works perfectly. Yeah. Cases of mistaken identity. You know, an issue like Graham Paul giving Joe Simonich 3 yellow cards, those kind of things, it's blatantly obvious that can happen in a matter of seconds, that a message can be relayed to say, you know, this situation is changing. But there aren't that many black and white issues in a game of football. If the Daniel Arzani penalty isn't given,
that's right.
Then, we're talking about issues of threshold and overturning the on-field referee's decision and not wanting to re-referee games. It's just, you're opening a Pandora's box, and you're still not going to satisfy people. This idea that VAR equals perfection isn't the case. And IFAB have, you know, they come out with some really mendacious communication that suggests that we're now at, you know, whatever, 99% accuracy rather than 95% accuracy. I actually don't think that 4% makes any difference whatsoever. Mm. It remains subjective and it remains emotional, and that doesn't change anything.
And, you know, I'm a big believer that one event on the pitch doesn't determine the outcome of that game. There's so many things that happen, mistakes made by players through the game that could determine the outcome of the game. But if there was one game where one result or one non-call, the way we had on the weekend, that VAR, you know, that usual round VAR, where three victory players were offside, victory were being outplayed at that time. At no time in the second half, even when they were controlling the game, did they look like they were peppering the Newcastle goals. I thought there was one game, one example of how one decision could affect the result of the game. That was it.
Yeah, but even so, we've watched football for decades. It was when Leroy George put his right foot to the ground, those players were onside. When his left foot hit the ball, they were offside. Mm. We're not talking about Maradona's hand of God. we're not. And it's not as if nobody saw Roy O'Donovan kick Lawrence Thomas in the head. This was a fractional call. It's not the kind of mistake that somebody deserves to be dragged over hot coals for. It's, you know, that's real-time football. Mm. Clearly you want those decisions to be made correctly. And
you mean if there was no VAR and the referee, yes, got it wrong, you know, just with the naked eye? Is that,
yeah,
what you say?
Yeah, exactly.
Of course. Yeah,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. It's not, you know, it's not the most egregious cock-up that you're ever going
to
see.
But you'd like to know whether that linesman said, "Oh, listen, it's tight, I'll let the VAR, yes, look for it, but I think it's off, but I'll just let it go, because then I won't be, if I get it wrong and they say that I've got it, you know, if I get it wrong and that's proven by VAR, I won't look like an idiot,
yes,
you know?" So I'd love to know what they were thinking.
Yes.
Yeah,
no,
so.
I agree entirely. And especially if their decision-making was influenced.
Mm. Mate, we've only got 2 minutes, and I wanted to talk to the Socceroos squad, but we'll have plenty of opportunity to speak Socceroos squads in the coming weeks, because obviously the team's going to be reduced from 32 to 26 and then 23.
Yeah. Headline take is the cupboard's bare.
Mm.
And there isn't a... You know, you look at previous squads and you talk about the borderline cases and who's desperately lucky not to make it. We're not going to have that this time, are we? Where it does feel like there's been a lot of digging around just to make that number. And particularly in a couple of positions, left back and right back, it feels like we're really, you know, pretty much everybody who could have been picked has been picked. Clearly the two massive decisions are Alzani and Cahill.
Yeah.
And that will be what really everybody focuses on once that Turkey camp is
happening. I love the Socceroos. It's the only team that I barrack for, probably in world football. So I get anxious watching them. So I care for the Socceroos. What will get me to that point a lot earlier than I would just watching them in the World Cup is Azani being picked.
Yeah.
I want to see him picked.
Yeah.
That'll excite me. And Tim Cahill, he'll get picked. He will get picked. But I want to see him play and influence the game too.
Yeah.
So, they're the two things I've got in mind. And Karasic, Fran Karasic, the young boy who's never set foot in Australia, playing in Croatia, who we've picked up too. And the idea that someone who doesn't know anything about Australia or very little about Australia wants to play for Australia, it's usually the other way around. So I'm really happy about that too. But let's leave that there, Jonathan. Yes. Great talking to you again today. Of course, had a great chat with Rabbi Crayham, the chairman of the AAFC. We'll see where that goes. We've got a lot to talk about with Socceroos coming forward and a lot of Congress issues, which you're all over to. You're actually the preeminent expert about the Congress in Australia. So we'll obviously be talking about that in the coming months also. But thanks for joining us today, mate.
Thanks, Carlos.
That's Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. That is the Wednesday edition of the Journos Done and Dusted. You can podcast the show on iTunes and SoundCloud. So until this time tomorrow, may you have a fantastic day in football.
The Journos on FNR, Football Nation Radio.